Headlines. French President Emmanuel Macron calls a national security meeting to discuss the Israeli-made Pegasus spyware after reports about its use in France. Iran's president announces the opening of the country's first oil export terminal outside the strategic Strait of Hormuz in the Gulf of Oman. And in China, tens of thousands of people are evacuated from a flood-stricken city as torrential rains continue to lash the central province of Henan. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, French President Emmanuel Macron has called a national security meeting following revelations that he may have been spied on using Israeli-made spyware. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen. On this edition, French President Emmanuel Macron has called for an unscheduled national security meeting to discuss the use of Israeli-made Pegasus spyware in his country. French government spokesman said Macron has taken the issue very seriously and is dedicating the meeting to the question of cybersecurity. The meeting comes amid recent reports showing the usage of Pegasus software for spying on international figures, including activists, journalists, and politicians. Macron himself has been enlisted as a potential target of the spyware created by an Israeli firm, NSO. It has been strongly criticized for the software's misuse for espionage activities in many countries, including the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Bahrain. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Christian Hond, who's joining us from the French capital, Paris. Also, we have author and journalist Gerud Okomain, also with us from the French capital. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Chris in Paris. Chris, what can you tell us about this national security meeting that has been called out of the blue by the French president?
NGOs, Forbidden Stories and Amnesty International revealed very recently that the Moroccan government spied phones of the Moroccan opposition journalists and also on important French journalists. Just some hours later, it has been revealed that the French president himself, Macron, and his former prime minister in 2019, Philippe, have been spied on by this program Pegasus. Now, it is becoming a large scandal because the Moroccan king says that he himself is being spied on by Pegasus and that he is not the source of the spying. So what is strange here is not the spying itself, because in the history of mankind, all states have always spied on other states or on their opposition. But what is strange here is that the technological source of the spying is a private company named NSO Group, and to make it even worse, it's a private Israeli company, which means that this company has access to all the contents of, it has been revealed, 50,000 worldwide telephones, and not just the content. It's the spyware enables monitoring the photos and the calls and the contacts of your phones. It's also doing a location tracking, even if your phone is turned off. And to make it worse, it's permitting the NSO Israeli group to hijack your microphone and the camera. So it's turning into a kind of constant surveillance device. So this makes the French government rather furious, because they are being spied on behalf of their conscience. So they want to know exactly who is spying on them and also why they are spied on.
Mr. Okomain, give us your thoughts on the commotion created by the Pegasus spyware, and what do you think the French government is worried about?
Well, there's a few aspects to this story which are curious. This comes at in a moment when the French government is struggling to basically stay in power due to the protest movement against the sanitary pass, which excludes an entire section of the population. So first thing to say about this is that this is a convenient distraction from a major social crisis in France. Secondly, the Israeli role here is important because of the centrality of Israel in high technology, the monopoly of high technology. A few years ago in Tel Aviv, former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that pretty much all of the big tech companies now were based in Israel and had their central operations in Israel, and that Israel would essentially own the internet, and they would own pretty much most of the big tech companies. And that would mean, of course, that big tech itself would become a wing of Zionism. So this is curious that you now have a situation where you have this company, Pegasus. It's involved with lots of different governments. It's spied on the Mexican government. It's been accused of facilitating Viktor Orban's government in Hungary, and their so-called spying on journalists. I think that there is spying going. Obviously, there is spying going on journalists everywhere. But one of the things that you have to bear in mind here, in the way in which the media are covering this, is that it's giving the impression that journalists in the West actually report things that are true that authorities don't want, and that simply isn't true. But I do think that even journalists with, for example, Le Monde and the mainstream news are spied upon to keep pressure on them. That's for sure. And that's the reason why they are always in line and they are always parroting the government line on pretty much everything. When it comes to freedom of speech, journalists and so on, France has political prisoners. It has journalists in jail, writers in jail for expressing their opinions. So let's just be clear. This has nothing to do with a democratic government that is now detected, a spyware and a national security threat. The French government is effectively a dictatorship. It has been for a long time. It's not the only one in Europe. There is an element of distraction to this story. But of course, I think the central message here that I want to get across is that Israel has taken over the internet. It has taken over information technology, the big tech companies, and it's much broader than Pegasus.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Chris Denhon, our correspondent, joining us from the French capital, Paris. Also, thanks to author and journalist Gerudo Colmain, also joining us from the French capital. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here. Elsewhere, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has announced the opening of a new oil export terminal in the Gulf of Oman that will allow the shipments to avoid the strategic Strait of Hormuz. Speaking during a cabinet meeting, Rouhani said the 1,000-kilometer pipeline is now operational at the port city of Jos. Rouhani noted that the pipeline was built in a matter of 2 years. He said the project is the Islamic Republic's most strategic one that has been accomplished during the current administration. The president added Iran's oil has been exported through the Gulf of Oman, and that's what makes this project very significant. Rouhani said the inauguration of this project is a firm response to plotters, particularly the United States. Palestinian prisoner has died in Israeli jail, with media reports suggesting the man succumbed to torture inside the prison. Abdul Yusuf Al-Khatib Al-Tamimi was found dead in a cell in a prison in the city of Al-Quds. Palestinian media say Israeli prison staff severely beat him and used electric shock against him, but Israeli authorities say Al-Tamimi died of a heart attack, a claim the victim's family has rejected, saying he has had no pre-existing medical conditions. Al-Tamimi was arrested for driving offenses and leaves behind a wife and four children. He is the latest victim among thousands of Palestinians languishing in Israeli prisons, many of them without charge. Palestinian prisoners are kept under deplorable conditions without proper hygienic standards. Many of them are subjected to systemic torture, harassment, and repression. Political analyst Saad Nimr says the international community must take action against Israel to make the regime stop violence against Palestinian prisoners.
The Israeli conduct generally against the Palestinian prisoners, in general, it's always to dehumanize the Palestinians. They never consider the Palestinian life matters at all. Now, concerning the Tamimi issue, apparently the brutality of the Israeli police, as the family had said, and based on witnesses who were there, They witnessed that he was beaten and he was assaulted against the law, and that what led to his death. What we need by the international community, not only a condemnation and statements of condemnation, but rather to start to take actions against the violation of the international law and the human rights laws. In this respect, we believe that international community should start putting pressure on Israel by economic means or by cutting or by really punishing the Israelis till they correct their records or till they stop these kind of atrocities against the Palestinians.
South Korea says the U.S. is awaiting Pyongyang's response to its offer for resuming denuclearization talks. The remark came from the office of South Korean President Moon Jae-in, that after a meeting between Moon and visiting U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman in Seoul. Sherman expressed hope that North Korea will soon respond to Washington's offer. She also said that she will discuss the issue with China during her visit there at the weekend as part of the East Asian tour. North Korea has so far given the cold shoulder to proposals from the administration of President Joe Biden for talks. It says the U.S. talk of diplomacy is all words and no action, and aimed at covering up its hostile acts. In China, more than 73,000 people have been evacuated from a flood-stricken city as torrential rains continue to lash the central province of Henan. Footage released by state media showed residents of Anyang City being evacuated by an excavator. At least 33 people have been killed in the province over the past couple of days. The victims include 12 passengers who were trapped in a submerged subway in the provincial capital, Zhengzhou. Several people remain missing. Authorities say the rainfall was the heaviest on record, with the rainstorm bringing almost a year's worth of precipitation in just 3 days. The deluge sparked the evacuation of over 200,000 people and disrupted transportation systems. The government has ordered an immediate review of subway flood controls and disaster relief measures. China has rejected a World Health Organization plan to audit Chinese labs as part of investigation into COVID origins, calling it arrogant and disrespectful.
This plan takes the hypothesis of China's violation of laboratory procedures causing virus leakage as one of the research priorities. From this point, I can feel the disrespect for common sense and arrogance towards science revealed in this plan.
Zhang added Beijing will not follow the proposal, saying it's opposed to politicizing the origin study. He said the Wuhan Institute of Virology has never designed, manufactured, or leaked COVID-19. He said so far the staff and graduate students of the Wuhan Institute have maintained zero infection of COVID-19. On Friday, the WHO proposed a second phase of studies into the pandemic origins, calling on China to be, quote, transparent and open to cooperate. China had earlier called on the UN Health Agency to maintain its scientific and professional positions in tracing the matter. Australian officials have warned that coronavirus cases could rise further as the country is struggling to contain a rapidly spreading Delta variant of the disease. The country's most populous state, New South Wales, reported 124 new infections, the highest in 16 months. Victoria State has logged 26 cases, a higher figure than a day before. The spike comes despite a weeks-long lockdown on over 13 million Australians, which has angered citizens. From the start of the pandemic, 915 Australians have succumbed to COVID-19. The overall caseload there is now hovering around 32,000. Authorities have been criticized for the slow vaccination process, with just 11% of the population being fully vaccinated so far. British supermarkets and suppliers have warned of a possible food shortage sparked by self-isolating staff amid rising coronavirus cases. British news outlets have released photographs of empty supermarket shelves as retailers' operations are affected by missing staff at stores and in supply chains. This comes as an official application is warning contacts of COVID patients to self-isolate for 10 days. The alerts have also forced thousands of workers in other industries and school kids to stay at home. Dubbed as the Pingdemic, the app has forced an additional 600,000 people to self-isolate in recent days, raising the total figure to 1 million. On Monday, the UK eased all virus curbs in England, while new cases are surging towards levels not seen since January. The war of words between British Prime Minister and his former chief aide is ongoing amid growing calls for a public inquiry into a pandemic that left the country with one of the worst death tolls in the world last year. Said Putazo has more.
Let the bodies pile on high in their thousands. A sentence seared into the memories of Britons, allegedly uttered by the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson as he reluctantly approved a second England-wide lockdown late last year. Faced with fury from relatives of the bereaved, Johnson and his senior ministers emphatically denied the allegation. The man who made that claim, his former top aide turned nemesis, Dominic Cummings, back with more.
This is terrible, but the people who are dying are essentially all over 80. And we can't kill the economy just because of people dying over 80.
Speaking to the British public broadcaster, he also questioned his former boss's fitness for his role and rebuked the government's pandemic performance. Just like that time, the government denies the allegations, saying the Prime Minister has taken the necessary action to protect lives and livelihoods, guided by the best scientific advice. But the numbers speak otherwise. England had one of the worst per capita deaths among the world's major economies last year, blamed by many on lockdown dithering by the government.
It was even more than that. It was an ideological predisposition towards laissez-faire capitalism and not caring about the fate of the poor. And that's deeply entrenched. They thought, let it spread through the population. Yes, the old will die, but they could use that crisis actually to generate pressure to further pursue the policies they're pursuing anyway, which are not protecting the NHS.
The new allegations come only days after Number 10 made England the first country to lift almost all COVID-related restrictions, despite the rising number of cases, mostly of the Delta variant.
If you look at this Tory cabinet, they look like people who are totally unfitted for office because they simply don't care about the lives and quality of lives of the vast majority of the working people of Britain. That's not their remit. They are there to protect big business. They've shown that time and again. The fact of Cummings and Johnson falling out is just once again shedding light on what they would really like to bury, and no doubt they will try and bury when they're forced to have a COVID inquiry.
A public inquiry into the government's pandemic response is yet to happen, and it remains to be seen if these latest revelations from the Prime Minister's former advisor will seriously puncture his opinion poll rates or lead to pressure from members of his own party for him to step down. Saeed Purizam, Press TV, London.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. We should not follow the lead of the United States in politics and in elections. We should not learn from Trump and Biden who insulted each other in their debates. These are not good examples and they should not be looked at. America's disastrous elections. In the eyes of the whole world, the election held by the enemies of Iran, the United States, was a scandalous election. They really did an awful job. Now the same scoundrels are criticizing our election. An American element commented on the Iranian election. Despite the scandal on their own plates, they have found their tongues after several months and speak against our elections. However, with the scandal that they crafted, they should not say a single word about any elections. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu Akbar. Expression of support for the president-elect by officials and other candidates. One point that one should thank God for is that after the election and the victory of the president-elect with a high percentage, the attitude of the country's official was a good one. This is a sign of the necessary peace and tranquility in the country. It is a very good thing for the high-ranking officials of the country to come and meet with the elected president to talk and to exchange views. It is a good thing that the candidates who did not win congratulated the candidate who did and expressed their interest and support for him. This is another divine blessing. We hope that God the Exalted will help us see more of these examples. Compare this to the behavior of the Americans and see how one treated the other after he won. You surely remember his words and statements then. Notice in what situation they were a few months ago. I hope that God the Exalted will bless the results of the elections. I hope that he will bless Mr. Raisi's new responsibility, both for himself and for the Iranian nation and the country. I hope that God the Exalted will bring the people's movement to fruition by showering blessings on them. I hope that he will help Mr. Raisi and other officials carry out the important tasks that fall on him with the assistance of the people. Greetings be upon you and God's mercy and blessings.
You've done for me through all my years. respond.
Every year, millions of Muslim pilgrims descend on Mecca for the Hajj pilgrimage. It's a religious obligation on all Muslims who are healthy, financially able, of sound mind, and of age to perform the pilgrimage at least once in their lifetime. The Muslim pilgrimage traditionally begins in Mecca. The pilgrims start by tawaf, circling the Kaaba counterclockwise 7 times and walking between the hills of Safa and Marwa. Pilgrims then spend a day praying in the Valley of Mina before heading to Arafat, some 20 kilometers east of Mecca. They then stone 3 pillars in Mina in a symbolic gesture of stoning the devil the following day. After the stoning, an animal is sacrificed to mark the first day of Eid al-Adha, when Muslims commemorate the willingness of Prophet Abraham to make any sacrifice commanded to him by God. The pilgrims conclude Hajj by returning to Mecca for the final tawaf. Although not part of a Hajj itself, many people round off the pilgrimage with a visit to the holy city of Medina, where the Prophet is buried. However, this year, like the year before, Saudi officials have restricted the number of pilgrims to the holy sites.
So obviously, it's going to be a challenge because COVID is a real virus, and it's really affecting the whole world. People have died from this virus, and we've seen what happened in Iran and different countries as well as in Canada. So, to have social distance is difficult when you're doing the pilgrimage. So that is obviously a problem as well. And it does have, restrictions to how much people can maybe attend a Hajj. But at the same time, the Saudi regime is taking advantage of this, right? And they have, pulled away from letting anybody come from different countries in the world.
This year, only 60,000 vaccinated residents of the kingdom are expected to take part. In a message issued on the occasion of the Hajj pilgrimage, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, said Muslim nations have been mostly subject to the aggressive Western countries' greed and interference over the past 150 years. The leader said Muslims should now make up for the past and stand firm against aggression and wickedness of the Western powers. The leader said resistance against the United States and other transgressing countries will help Muslims take their fate into their own hands. He urged Muslims to rush to the assistance of their fellows in Palestine, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other countries where the U.S. and its cohorts have been interfering for years.
The intervention in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Afghanistan, all these countries that are in the Middle East that are Islamic by nature, that the majority of people there are Muslims, the American intervention in their hands are in there, and it caused a lot of sedition, a lot of divisions, a lot of problems, and now a lot of countries are suffering economically because the resources are not being used towards liberating their lands and to be more sovereign. And we have puppets that are working in all different countries, unfortunately serving the great Satan, America.
The leader said resistance fighters are eloquently expressing their firm decision to confront every act of interference and malice on the part of the U.S. and its cohorts. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the U.S. seeks to distort the will, demands, and actions of resistance forces in the region. He stressed that such efforts stem from America's deep ignorance about awake and alert regional nations. Ayatollah Khamenei concluded that the primary result of a struggle in the way of God will be to prevent America and other international aggressors from interfering in the affairs of Islamic countries.
On July 19, 2019, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps detained the UK-flagged oil tanker Stena Impero in the Strait of Hormuz, a channel that links the Persian Gulf with the Oman Sea and the Indian Ocean. In a statement, the IRGC said the Swedish-owned vessel had been impounded with its 23 crew members aboard at the request of the Ports and Maritime Organization of Hormuzgan Province for failing to respect international maritime rules. The British tanker had violated the maritime regulations by switching off its tracking systems. It also disregarded the established procedures by making an entry from the exit point of the Strait of Hormuz in the south instead of Northern Pass. The oil tanker was then escorted to Iran's Bandar Abbas port for further legal procedures and investigations. The head of Hormozgan Ports and Maritime Organization said Stena Impero ignored distress calls as it collided with a fishing boat on its route.
The vessel, to avoid inspections that we must have conducted in this collision incident, changed its route. This jeopardized the safety of shipping lanes in the region and gravely violated international regulation on passage in marine areas. Accordingly, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' naval forces guided the vessel to harbor at the port city of Bandar Abbas for inspection as well as technical investigation of the circumstances, effects, and causes of the incident in accordance with international regulations.
Tensions escalated between Iran and the UK following the seizure of Stena Impero. Britain described the seizure as a dangerous act and called for the release of the vessel.
We need to see the illegal seizing of a British flagged vessel reversed. We need that ship released. And we continue to be very concerned about the safety and welfare of the 23 crew members.
However, Iran said the seizure of the British vessel was legal. It said collisions happen in the Strait of Hormuz, but regulations require those involved to respond to regional authorities' inquiries. After 2 months in detention, Iran's inquiry into the tanker's conduct was completed and a resolution to the matter was reached. Stena Impero set sail in September and left Iranian waters for Dubai, putting an end to 2 months of row. In early June, British Marines assisted Gibraltar to seize an Iranian supertanker off the southern coast of Spain. Gibraltar's officials claimed the ship was transporting crude oil to Syria in violation of EU sanctions imposed on Damascus. Moreover, Britain defended the seizure of Iran's supertanker as a legal move. Meanwhile, Washington praised the move and hailed it as a sign of Europe acting along the line of US unilateral sanctions against Tehran. However, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif slammed the detainment of Iran's tanker and described it as piracy, adding that the objective behind Iran's actions was to uphold international maritime rule. Also, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran would respond to Britain's piracy over the seizure of an Iranian oil tanker in Gibraltar.
So it's an unbelievable arrogance on the part of the Western powers, but then they've been demonstrating that for most of the 20th century and all of this century.
U.S. sanctions on Iran's oil, U.K. seizure of Iranian supertanker, and sabotage operations on oil ships are all instances of the West's actions that have caused turmoil in the international energy market. Add to this list the economic warfare waged by Israel against Iran. A Wall Street Journal report in March revealed that Israel had systematically struck at least 12 Iranian ships. However, Iran has time and again shown its adversaries that their illegal acts in the Persian Gulf will not be left unanswered.
The discovery of an unmarked graveyard at a former residential school run by the Catholic Church in the Canadian province of British Columbia in May, which contained at least 215 human remains, mostly young children, prompted an outpouring of grief and anger and a wider investigation into similar boarding schools that were opened from the late 19th century to the mid-1990s. The probes have so far found some 1,100 bodies at the sites of former residential schools in the provinces of British Columbia and Saskatchewan. A Canadian researcher whose works contributed to the uncovering of the first mass grave has said the discoveries so far have barely scratched the surface. The residential school system in Canada was established in 1883 under the country's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald. The aim was to assimilate Indigenous peoples in Canada and destroy their languages and culture. By the 1920s, attending residential schools had been made mandatory for children aged between 7 and 15.
But these have been going on for years. The residential school survivors just basically were ignored. The now today it seems a shock to some people, but it shouldn't be a shock because this was known that it was the policy in Canada. It was also the policy in the United States. They just pull these kids out of their homes, and they wanted to indoctrinate them. And that's exactly what they tried to do.
Some 150,000 children were separated from their parents, often under threats of persecution. The first mass grave in British Columbia was found after Indigenous elders recollected the memories of young children digging holes in the ground. The survivors have told harrowing stories of how the mistreatment and abuse the children were subjected to at the former residential schools led some to attempt suicide or try to escape.
Many of our children who ran away during the winter and froze to death on their way home. And the quiets, the black robes, start lying about the children. Oh yeah, they're doing fine here. In the meantime, they were missing. And no one had searched for them.
A former student of the Cooper Island Industrial School has described the place as Canada's Alcatraz. In a 2015 report, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada called the practices employed in the former schools, quote, cultural genocide.
We're trying to say, people trying to say now, cultural genocide, as if it doesn't fit in the description of the word genocide as defined by the United Nations. I mean, it's very clear that that's what they did.
These are the hard truths that are part of Canada's history. These are the hard truths we must confront as a society.
The Canadian government has vowed to fulfill the Indigenous people's demands to fund investigations into the graves around the country, but it's come under criticism for failing to do so earlier, as the discoveries made so far have been funded by the Indigenous groups themselves. The First Nations leaders say over 6,000 children died at the schools from causes like disease, accident, and suicide, but there's no clear picture of how many children lost their lives throughout the years. That means there will be more headlines about mass graves discoveries around Canada in the months to come.
The United Arab Emirates is among a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States and condemned by Palestinians. The Emiratis, who have been particularly open about their ongoing normalization process, opened an embassy in Israel this week.
The UAE has never been known for having an independent foreign policy. It has never stood for the rights of Palestinian people. Historically and recently, as you have seen, the UAE has always aligned its foreign policy with the foreign policy objectives of Western countries like the US and UK.
The new embassy is located in the heart of Israel's financial hub, Tel Aviv's Stock Exchange building. This is seen by many as a sign that the two sides are highlighting the role of economic cooperation in their normalization of ties. Last month, Israel opened an embassy in the Emirati capital Abu Dhabi and a consulate in the UAE's business hub Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals, ranging from financial services to tourism. Critics say Emirati leaders have totally abandoned the Palestinian cause for the economic and political dividends of ties with the Israeli regime. The controversial normalization process is very much ongoing, despite Palestinian anger. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stances adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinian movement Hamas says this week's embassy opening, quote, marks an insistence on the great sin against the people of Palestine and all the nations of the region. It warned that the move would encourage the regime to press ahead with its crimes in the occupied territories and in the besieged Gaza Strip. Observers warn that the embassy opening just weeks after Israel's deadly onslaught against the Gaza Strip and the escalation of the regime's violations in the occupied West Bank indicates that some Arab states are no longer bound by the Palestinian cause. Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel. The Palestinian issue was once a unifying cause among Arab countries. But Israel, backed by the United States, has apparently managed to divide them more than ever. Israel has been especially thankful to the United States for pushing the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan to normalize their ties with the regime. America has always been a staunch ally of Israel, but former U.S. President Donald Trump was perhaps the best friend of the Israelis in a very long time. His extremely pro-Israel decisions and policies are still impacting the lives of people in the West Asia region, especially those in Palestine. The Palestinians say they have come to the conclusion that America's heavily biased stance leaves no room for any further U.S. mediation role regarding Palestine in the future.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Life and personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Month of Wilaya from IRIB English Radio. Sayyid Ali al-Musavi al-Jazairi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Allahumma salla ala Muhammadin wa alihi at-tahirin. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I hope that you are keeping well and you are doing well and we are fine as long as you are fine. First of all, I want to express my warm congratulations on the precious, auspicious occasion of the holy month of Dhul Hajjah, the month of Wilayah, and the month of the Commander of the Faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib. May God's peace and blessings be upon him. I hope that by the grace and blessing of God, we will be able to take benefit as much as possible from the blessings and the bounties of this great month, inshallah. Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Commander of the Faithful, wa Imam al-Muttaqeen, the leader of the pious, wa Sayyid al-Wasiyyin, the master of all divinely designated successors of God's prophets and apostles, is truly unique in the fact that if you know enough about him, you cannot help but fall in love with him. We are drawn to Ali because we are all drawn to virtue and goodness. Ali is a human personification of all that is good. In the sky of Ali's virtues and perfections, there are numerous shining stars and bright planets. The sky of Ali's infinite virtues and merits embodies all praiseworthy and admirable characteristics and features that we may have the capacity to think about. All qualities and virtues that make a universal man universal. Who wouldn't marvel at a dignity, piety, generosity, heroism, forbearance, perseverance, and all other possible human features and qualities that are represented and embodied in the reality of the existence of Ali? The commander of the faithful is a truly unique character because he's the only person in history who's been able to combine and bring together all those antithetical qualities in the same human being. For instance, when you perceive this personality from the perspective of his asceticism and his total disregard for the material aspect of this world, when you hear about his strange spiritual states while conversing with the Lord of the creation, when you read in history about his weeping and crying while supplicating God in the middle of the dark nights in a corner of some palm groves in the city of Medina or Kufa, when you know this fact that Ali used to pray and then the fear of God would make him fall unconscious and fall to his face like a stiff, lying dead, cold corpse, you may come to this conclusion that Ali has been a personality whose attention was only focused on the material, on the spiritual aspect of this life, and he had nothing to do with the material life. But when you look at the same personality from the viewpoint of his arduous diligence in establishing and constructing and developing a comfortable and respectable life for every single member of the Islamic society, and in particular the needy and the poor, you wonder if he had any time to do anything else. It's narrated in history that the commander of the faithful planted thousands of palm trees while residing in the city of Medina before his exterior and apparent caliphate. It's narrated in history that the commander of the faithful dug more than 100 wells by his own hands. Amir al-Mu'mineen bought more than 1,000 slaves, paying from his own income, and then he trained and educated and prepared them for a prosperous, godly life, and then he released all of them in the way of God. He was so engaged in cultivation to the extent that he was called by the people Abu Turab, the father of soil, because he was seen in numerous occasions, and while his holy face and hair and clothes were covered by dust. So when you look at this personality from this perspective, and when you notice this face of the life of the commander of the faithful, you may arrive at this conclusion that he was the person who focused all his attention on the material aspect of the life, and he was the one who had nothing to do with his hereafter. But with regards to this unique character, both these extreme views and opinions are wrong, because he was the one who successfully managed to create and keep this spectacular balance between his hereafter and his material life. Another instance, Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the faithful, was the bravest hero in the battlefield. He was the greatest commander of any army because he was always at the very forefront. He was a soldier before being a general. He was the most ferocious in the face of the enemies of God. His armor never had the back part because he never turned his back on his enemy in order to flee from the battlefield. He's the same man who smashed open the gate of Khaybar single-handedly. He's the one who never shiver or shake when faced with an army of thousand. And yet, whenever he saw an orphan child, he would collapse. All that valor, all that strength, all that power, Ali ibn Abi Talib would lose it in an instant of seeing someone who is oppressed, of someone who is poor, and of someone who is orphan. Inshallah, in the next programs, we will talk more about the virtues and the merits of this unique personality. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Of chains. Part 4.
Where is the line between these NGOs and political parties? Aren't NGOs supposed to be the corrective factor of all levels of government instead of betting on who'll get into the government? The goal of these NGOs, however, was something else.
We all gathered ourselves pretty much on the same values and same goals that we thought would be good for Serbia for more than 10 years in different settings of us knowing each other more or less. And whenever we recruit new interims or whoever, we always refer them to our website, to our manifesto, and openly say that we are in favor of Serbian NATO membership.
But it doesn't stop there. These NGOs don't wait for citizens to become legal adults in order for those NGOs to start recruiting them or shaping their opinions on various political or social issues.
We have, for example, many educational programs now 10 years, mostly secondary school children and students. So we have human rights schools, which last 10 days. We gather children from all over Serbia, from different backgrounds. We select usually 30 children. In 10 days, and it's a very intensive program, they really change. In what way? They're offered a framework, a referential framework to think. You just have to guide them, to tell them what is wrong and what is good, what is evil, you know. So these elementary things, just to show them direction. They easily accept it.
Yes, children do tend to get brainwashed more easily. That's why NGOs don't waste time in making it clear who are the world's good guys.
The West is almost a synonym for democracy, for the respect of human rights and rule of law, for individual liberties.
But hey, I'm sure these NGOs can be critical towards the West as well, despite receiving money from them.
Do I think that the United States might be unfair sometimes towards someone, somebody? Yes, yes, of course. No one is perfect.
Do you have any examples of that?
Sure. I don't know. Now I have hard times imagining the example, but maybe...
That's okay. It's not like the United States or the CIA ever admit to making mistakes either.
The United States and the CIA as one of its implements made mistakes and makes mistakes all the time.
Oh, so the former CIA director does admit that, but Dušan Gamzer can't think of any mistakes.
I don't know.
Talk about being more Catholic than the Pope.
Because they are technically non-governmental, whatever they do, the country that they're acting in, you can't accuse the United States of doing it because it's a non-governmental organization that is doing this subversion.
Some other countries knew how to deal with this. In 2012, Russian President Vladimir Putin approved a law which was previously cleared with overwhelming support by Parliament, obliging NGOs that receive funding from abroad to register as foreign agents. The U.S. State Department quickly condemned the law, which was really odd considering that the U.S. passed a very similar law, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, back in 1938.
Today's threat to our national security is not a matter of military weapons alone. We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse, the fifth column, spies, saboteurs, and traitors. Our moral and our mental defenses must be raised up as never before against those who would cast a smokescreen across our vision.
The U.S. law requires groups representing the interests of foreign powers in a political or quasi-political capacity to disclose their relationship with the foreign government and information about related activities and finances. This law is still in effect in the U.S.
If America really is about freedom, democracy, and the rule of law, then it should be doing the same sort of thing in Saudi Arabia, but they don't. Let's have a look at the situation for women. They barely have any rights. Their rights in education is restricted. They're restricted when it comes to elections. So that just shows what Saudi Arabia is like domestically. But you could argue there's even a more sinister aspect to Saudi Arabia. It was Saudi Arabia that gave birth to Al-Qaeda, from 9/11 to Bali, to Madrid, to London, to Damascus. The roots go all the way back to Saudi Arabia.
Wow, from what this guy's saying, Saudi Arabia sounds like a horrible place. It must be on top of America's terrorist list.
Well, they're not at all on top of America's terrorist list. Saudi Arabia is one of America's closest allies in the world because of the business links there. If the Americans were so sincere about protecting and encouraging human rights in the world and democracy, there'd be an American naval flotilla off the coast of Saudi Arabia. It's one of the most wicked regimes in the world.
The foreign-funded civil society issue had little to do with human rights, and even less with democracy. In Introducing Democracy, a book written by David Beetham and Kevin Boyle, and published by UNESCO for the education of people in newly established democracies on human rights and political freedoms, it said that an influence of an NGO on a government can be democratic only if it stems from mass membership, and not that which stems from the accumulation of wealth or power in the hands of a few. In Serbia, according to their websites or statutes, the Center for Cultural Decontamination had 14 members, the Helsinki Board for Human Rights had 9 members, the Humanitarian Law Center had 8 members, and the Center for Euro-Atlantic Studies had 4 members. As for the funding, despite these organizations practically framing the word transparency on their walls, they never were very transparent regarding how much money they received. So I did a little investigative work and sent out questionnaires to all of the sponsors of the organizations that I mentioned, asking how much money they gave to the NGOs. A few actually replied. This was just the tip of the iceberg. So much for mass membership with no accumulation of wealth. For a group of organizations supportedly promoting democracy at every corner, they weren't very democratic at all. At least by UNESCO standards. Some of the individuals working in these NGOs advocated full acceptance of everything the International Monetary Fund demands, despite the lessons from Greece, Ecuador, and many other countries.
I don't think West is enslaving us. I think West is liberating us. International Monetary Fund is liberating us, accepting